Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Whether they write songs of protest, pen drama, poetry, fiction, produce paintings or murals, artists often spring to the forefront of a movement, pressing for more, inspiring those within, touching those without. This is never more true than with the movements revolving around African-American slavery, racism, and civil rights. To celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. today, we want to explore how art has been used across time to lift up and add volume to his mission and the larger civil rights movement. Kazaray Abdul-Ghani is an assistant professor of African-American literature and the digital humanities at Temple University. Kazaray Abdul-Ghani, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Ann, for having me.
What do we know about the history of this? Does this go back to the beginning of expression, artistic expression? That sometimes it can be a surreptitious way to make a statement in a movement. But all things being equal, it's always been there.
Yes, I would say that it's always been there. I would say that the artist has always been inspired by what's going on in the world. And when we think about politics, when we think about, you know, different cultural shifts, the artist takes that in and thinks about how can they use that expression to humanize what's going on in the world as well. So we see that across time.
And is there anything particular about times of social unrest then? Do they spike then at times like that?
Yes, I would. If we think about, since we're celebrating the life and legacy of Martin Luther King, thinking about what he was going through at the end of his life in terms of the racial upheaval, I think people tend to forget that there were many uprisings that happened between 1964 and 1967, where he is going to places such as New York City and Chicago. And so there's this way of thinking about that, but also how the young artists of the time during the civil rights movement, the Black arts movement, are using, you know, the art that they are creating in order to explain that message, to humanize why African Americans at the time are creating, you know, uprising. Why are they mad? What are their grievances? Because the grievances happen because there's no response to the significant problems, which were, you know, housing insecurity, issues of voting rights, food insecurity, those types of things. And so the artists, I would say, artists such as Gwendolyn Brooks, the poet, when we think about Sonia Sanchez, those were women that spoke about, you know, healing through art and also speaking to the civil unrest, as you are speaking about.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the intersection of the arts and politics, social unrest, civil unrest, and social justice movements in the United States. My guest right now is Kazaray Abdul-Ghani. She is Assistant Professor of African-American Literature and the Digital Humanities at Temple University. If you have been inspired, if the arts in the social justice movement have had a particular impact on you and you want to talk about something you've seen or created, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, I'm kind of interested in what role the actual image of someone like Martin Luther King plays in it. He's iconic now. He's an everyday recognizable face. I suppose Barack Obama is too, and a lot of other people, but some of the artists you were talking about are largely, unless you're a scholar, are not everyday household names across the country.
Well, yes and no. Sonia Sanchez has, you know, been around for a while, mm-hmm. So she has won, you know, significant awards recently. I think that when we talk about King's iconic image, if we think about the current artists out there, Nicholas Smith, who is an artist and a writer, he's known for the iconic image of Martin Luther King Jr. in a hoodie, right? So when the issues of the killing of Trayvon Martin happened, and trying to connect and make synonymous what was happening in the past in terms of racial upheaval and what is happening currently. And so I think that that's another example of how you think about some things that, as Amir Baraka talked about, the changing same, what remains here, but what are we doing to try to change it, and also to empower people and inspire people to think and talk about King's legacy, but also that King is not, departed or, not apart from, the issues of today's time. His legacy speaks to it very much so.
I'm wondering how the use of art changes or makes it easier to speak truth to power. Revere our freedom of expression in this country. It's not the case everywhere, sadly, but it is an avenue for expression. And when everything else is going wrong.
Absolutely. Art is a universal language. So if we may not understand, if we're speaking about African Americans and what African Americans are speaking about in terms of Black lives mattering, if we can think about it through art and seeing on the streets the letters Black Lives Matter, and then the images that come of Black families, of memorializing Black people who have succumbed to violence, whether it's by a policeman's bullet or whether it's from, what's going on in the community. I think art gives us a way to speak about what is going on in ways that maybe some difficult dialogue, right, may, deter people from coming together and speaking about these issues. So art is definitely a universal language in how we can bring about change and awareness.
In Columbus and other cities across the country, after the death of George Floyd, the Black Lives Matter movement, the Say His Name meme, I suppose. And now we, of course, he's another very recognizable person of color. The way the public art went up around the city, instead of just the plywood, they inspired and encouraged, I say they being, the powers that be, to paint over this and make more of it than just the detritus of demonstrations and riots.
So can you clarify that a little bit?
Well, I think it was different this time. They were aggrandizing. They were making a point by having the public art installations where there had been damage. They made it art instead.
Yes. And I think that connects. I think that there is also a parallel, because in the 60s, you had the Wall of Respect in Chicago, right? And you had other murals. I mean, you have murals now in Philadelphia, in San Francisco, where it's to not only show the grievance in front of you, but what comes out of African-American art or art of the African diaspora is the joy. There's still joy there in celebration of Black life. And so that is sort of connecting with also still addressing the grievance. So the grievance, and one of the things that I also teach and I write about is how civil unrest, where we do see the violence that happens in terms of the breaking up of property. Well, that happened instantaneously in order to receive responses from the grievances, in order for politicians to say, okay, we're going to respond in some way. Because, you know, there were protesters believing that we weren't going to get any response. So I think that in seeing sort of this, you know, way of looking at devastation, but also looking at the beauty of it, we have to see how that has also worked in American history, right? And also the ways that African-American artists, writers, and everyday people have used that as a way to speak about the grievances, but also that joy, and also bring about ways to think of, you know, social change. I think that's what we're seeing right now.
I mentioned earlier that obviously in this country we have the freedom of expression, but not everybody always had the freedom of expression in this country, obviously. Mm-hmm. Art can be a way of expressing all of that in code, in a way, right?
Yes, right. Absolutely. And so if you think about, you know, African-American visual art, songs, I mean, there's a lot of code, right? I mean, if we think about the spirituals, coded language, about getting to freedom and liberation. So I think that that's definitely an inherited message that continues even to this day. It's about liberation. How do we get free? You know, and how are we, you know, recognized as full citizens of the country, of the United States?
When we talk about public art, whether it's a graffiti-like, message or something more formalized, like the plywood that was used to paint all, you know, where all kinds of images were painted after the Black Lives Matter demonstrations. I'm wondering how what about the art of drama and music, particularly drama and literary endeavors, and how they have been over time and historically not been given the notice, because you have to get a publisher to publish you, right? You have to get a playhouse, you know, a theater to stage a performance. It's a real different kind of thing. And now there's more works coming out from decades ago now that we know were kept from us.
Yes, absolutely. And I examined some of those works. So I look at Sister Sanji by Sonia Sanchez. I look at Rioter Revolt by Henry Dumas. And also thinking about Right Dutchman and the Slave by Amiri Baraka, but more so looking at the slave, that play, and how those plays actually speak to our time when thinking about the social and civil unrest that was occurring in the 60s, but also what's happening in the 21st century. I think there's some irony there, but also there is a way to learn that there was a reason why these dramas and short stories were kept in, you know, closed spaces, right? They were just kept in within African American circles. Because when you think about it now, how would it have inspired all of us, not just those who are of African descent, but how would it inspired all of us to sort of engage and talk about these issues of social unrest, which really link back to the societal concerns of housing, of environmental issues, you know? And so I think reading those, and they're one-act plays as well. Mm-hmm. They're very short and to the point and concise in terms of being didactic and teaching us a lesson. So what are the lessons that we can learn from it? Well, one of the lessons that I've learned is that we have to talk about the grievances and why they are grievances and why people are expressing their grievances through anger, because that isn't an emotion, and that is, you know, an emotion that we like to sort of suppress. But also what comes out of that emotion, if we work through it, right, is some resolve. There can be resolve. But what some of these works tell us is that what happens when there is resolve and what happens when there is not. And I think right now in this time where we're thinking about these political changes and how the artist is using their art in order to humanize these experiences, the resolve, hopefully it's coming, but we still have to speak through it. And so I think works from the past can help us with that.
You mentioned the Dutchman earlier, and which is one of the most chilling things I've ever read, because I haven't seen it performed. But but I'm wondering about that. To me, today is more relevant than ever, as we kind of try to figure out how we learn about the relationships and the relational issues of racism in this country.
Absolutely. Yes.
It's amazing how contemporary it is in its way.
Yes. But I would say that, you know, it's circulatory as well. And that, you know, we can always point to how relevant it is. And so that tells us, right, that we still have to continue the work, this racial justice work.
Well, Kazareh Abdulghani, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Anne, for having me. Have a good day.
You too. That's Kazareh Abdulghani. She's an assistant professor of African American literature and digital humanities at Temple University. We're going to continue our conversation with another scholar, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're looking at the relationship between art and political movements. The Harlem Renaissance, which spanned roughly 1920 to 1930, is a revered period of African-American history and creativity, a time of unparalleled excellence in Black culture expressed via literature, music, theater, and art. But was it a political movement? Gary Holcomb is a professor of African-American studies at Ohio University. Among other things, Holcomb co-edited Harlem Renaissance author Claude McKay's Never Before published circa 1929 to 1933, Romance in Marseille for Penguin Random House. Gary Holcomb, welcome to All Sides.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Anne. I'm glad to be here.
What would you describe the Harlem Renaissance as, a political movement?
Well, it's one of the major debates about the Harlem Renaissance. And going back decades, you know, scholars and critics and you know, readers of the Renaissance and so forth, debating this whole question. There was a moment around around the 60s, 70s period when some aspects of the Renaissance were regarded as political, but the dominant sort of, the dominant sort of discourse about it, I suppose, was that it was really more of an art for arts movement. It was more of a, you know, not quite apolitical, but it wasn't deeply politically invested. And I think the reason for this might have been mostly because during the 1960s and 70s, you know, Black power was going on, Black arts movement was going on, and which of course, Black arts movement was completely dedicated to political art, Black political art. But recently, and by recent, I mean the last 20 or more years, in Harlem Renaissance scholarship, a whole sort of definition of the Renaissance has taken place. Scholars have been talking about how it was a deeply political movement, depending on who we're talking about. Du Bois, for example, you know, said, I don't care for any art that isn't propaganda. And what he meant by that, it sounds quite, you know, controversial in and of itself, using that word propaganda like that in the 1920s. What he really meant was, he wanted Harlem Renaissance, or what was called New Negro period art, to be political and not to be sort of the opposite end of the, I guess, of the spectrum, which would be the sort of what was recognized as politically neutral or not interested in political you know, issues, the modernists like Fitzgerald and Hemingway and that kind of thing. He, you know, people who were writing novels and producing, you know, poetry and so forth, who's really, you know, the sort of white modernist view was art must not be political. That was a corruption. But Du Bois said all art must be propaganda. And then even those who disagreed with aspects of Du Bois's call for all propaganda, like Claude McKay, he was deeply political in his fiction and poetry writing. Langston Hughes wrote, especially later on in the early 1930s period, wrote these one act agitation propaganda plays, you know, where, you know, the whole point was to get the audience roused to go outside and join unions, black unions, and form black unions. I mean, you know, fight for labor and voting rights and other kinds of civil liberties. So in a word, yes, the New Negro movement was political. And this is not to criticize those earlier sort of visions of it that wanted to highlight its artistic, a brilliance, if you were. It was both. It was both artistic and political, I think, and at least in its most successful kind of forms.
And when we think of the Harlem Renaissance, there's also criticisms out there that it was too narrowly defined by Harlem per se. There is a big Renaissance movement in Washington, D.C., too. But then yet other people will still say yes. But particularly when it came to performance, they traveled all over the country, these performers, these artists, to places as remote as Columbus, Ohio, you know, mm-hmm. to share the art of the day.
Yeah. New Negro movement, almost synonymous with Harlem Renaissance, roughly late teens, 20th century late teens to a roughly mid 1930s. You know, the periodization is a little bit up in the air, but yeah, it was the New Negro movement was a national movement, even a transnational movement. If we think about Marcus Garvey's connections, you know, with Jamaica, and we think about, of course, the so-called, you know, Garvey kind of represented a second or third stage of back to Africa, you know, mm-hmm. ideology and so forth. And so this transnationalism of the Renaissance made it something, I think, that, yeah, to confine it to a single space of a neighborhood in New York City is a bit, it's a form of making a narrative out of something, I think. And on the other hand, those people in Washington, D.C., those people in Cleveland who are doing great black drama, people in Columbus, you know, who was out in Los Angeles, who saw themselves as part of the Renaissance, they acknowledged that Harlem was the epicenter, you know, that it really was. I mean, Langston Hughes packed up his things in the Midwest and moved to Harlem to go to Columbia University because he wanted to be Columbia, you know, campus is right there in Harlem practically. Claude McKay, another example, was going to college in Kansas and he read about this Renaissance going on in this neighborhood of New York City, and he just, like Langston Hughes, packed his things. Zora Neale Hurston came up from the South. She made her way through Washington, D.C. She was a student of Alain Locke at Howard University, and then she went on to become an anthropologist at Barnard College, Columbia University. So yes, the New York is significant, particularly Harlem is significant, but it is, you know, we have to be careful about thinking of this Renaissance taking place in this single place. Washington, D.C. is important for women's writing. The poet George Douglas Johnson held a salon there And she invited poets from, you know, Black poets and writers from all over to come every, you know, she called the Saturday Nighters, to come this open house, talk about their writing. And eventually she decided it should be for women, because not that she wanted to exclude men, but she felt like women authors should have their own kind of conversation.
It's interesting, because when you look at pure politics of all of this, women definitely take the back seat, so to speak, to the men. You know, we can talk about all kinds of instances where that was the case, but generally the civil rights movement writ large is dominated clearly by men. The arts movement wasn't necessarily.
Harlem Renaissance, some believe, and I'm inclined to agree, was around the mid-1920s began to be dominated by male intellectuals and artists. And I think even the reputation of the Renaissance that we still have today, we folk, except for Zora Neale Hurston, we tend to think of male authors like Langston Hughes, Du Bois, McKay, and people like that. And that's just not the way it was historically. The Renaissance begins in the teens with women's drama, with a play called Rachel, by Angelina Weld Grimke. It was staged in 1915, all Black production in, you know, and then if we mark that as the beginning of the Renaissance and women are producing, Nella Larsen's Passing, just recently a new film made by a British director, I'm forgetting her name right now, very interesting new film of Nella Larsen's 1929 novel, Passing. Passing is a significant text to the Harlem Renaissance, is my point. And then finally, if we say that Zora Neale Hurston's 1937, Their Eyes Are What, Rebecca Hall, right? If we say that Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Are Watching God is, I think it's the crowning achievement of the Harlem Renaissance, but it appeared in 1937. And the most important thing about that novel, one of the most important things about that novel, is the great art of giving voice to women of color, but not just women of color, but also women of color who are at the lowest sort of social standing. You know, Passing covers Black middle class, you know, women. And a lot of the Harlem Renaissance writing, understandably, I think, by Black women, you know, they're writing about the sort of the Black bourgeoisie, understandably, because no one had written about those people before, at least not in the way that they wanted to write about. I think it certainly is something that Toni Morrison talked about, the Black, I mean, it sort of indirectly criticized the Black arts movement in the 60s and 70s for being, and other, you know, Alice Walker, of course, you know, criticized the Black arts movement for focusing too heavily on a kind of masculine militant art. The Black power, yeah. You know. And I think the Renaissance, it didn't suffer from quite that problem, if, of course, one agrees with those views. I'm inclined to agree with Toni Morrison on this. But yes, it was going on. And there were... it's interesting because some African-American women said, well, we have to, you know, on the question of Black feminism, they would say, well, our first, you know, sort of accomplishment must be to overcome racism, you know? And it is almost as if some thought they should take a back seat. Women's rights should sort of take a back seat until white supremacy was addressed. I think they... You know, it's a common, you know, sort of a belief that that many in the Renaissance underestimated racist imperialist power.
How long it would take, yeah. And you know, I mean, obviously, there was a huge schism in the, you know, movement for the women's vote, too. I mean, they were kept out of that as well. It wasn't just gender-based. They were kept out of powerful positions there. I wanted to ask you before I have to let you go, because I'm really interested when I read about what the work you did reclaiming and bringing to be published, Claude McKay's book, Romance in Marseille. You know, tell me how you found that. what it's about and where it came from, and why it's important that these works find the light of day.
Well, I can't claim that I found it. I read about it in an old biography now, an old biography of Claude McKay by a guy named Wade Cooper. And he had just a little bit about it. Here's the story. Basically, they're in the archive of the New York Public Library, that was called the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, is the full typescript of this novel, never published. I spent, I know this sounds really heroic on my part, I spent nearly 20 years trying to get it into print because I was just knocked out by this text. A West African protagonist who is severely disabled. He makes his way back to Marseille he's part of a kind of a countercultural black and white queer communist, you know, group of people.
He's hitting all the buttons.
And, you know, I got it into print. Penguin Classics published it in 2020. Unfortunately, you know, that was February 2020. March 2020 came along and, you know.
Yeah.
But the novel itself is a fascinating document because it's sort of a key text. You know, all the things that were left out of other texts appear in this particular text, you know. And by no means does he idealize these characters. And that's one of the beautiful things about the novel, is that he tries to make them as real as he can. One fascinating thing in terms of just looking at the novel in terms of the presence of women, the novel, the protagonist is ostensibly this West African guy who is, as I say, severely disabled. But McKay himself said that there's a North African, a Moroccan black sex worker who she takes over the novel in a sense. It's almost like a postmodern kind of gesture, you know. She takes over the novel and she really becomes the protagonist, and her story becomes really very important. She's trying to figure out how to get out of prostitution and so forth. And she wants to, as it were, go back to Africa, even though she herself has never been to whatever, you know, Black Africa, right? This whole assumption about North Africa not being, this anthropological idea of not being Black Africa. Mm-hmm. So, I think the novel, and then it's got queer characters in it. It's got,
Well, I'm eager to look at it and read it because I feel like it's going to be something of a time capsule. Because of the way I heard it described or read described is that it doesn't pull any punches. It's not trying to romanticize any of this. It's just, it was what it was and that time, and that's how it was. And
I was going to say that when it came out, I was blown away because, national press, national media just picked it up and ran with it. I've been thinking a lot about why it resonates with contemporary readers. I mean, it's obvious why it resonates with contemporary readers because of, all those readers who didn't have a text with these characters in them before that they could that they could read about and see themselves in a past of 100 years ago. That's a major sort of, way in which text can resonate, you know, with us. So past texts like this, almost 100 years old like this, can not only tell us something important about their past, but they can tell us something about our present and how we got here. I find it kind of this idea of being a key text very interesting in this regard. And I like, you know, for example, the Washington Post reviewed it and called it woke. the New York Magazine Vulture section said it's the best novel written best novel published this year, 2020, right? Granted, she wrote that, the author wrote that in February, but the point so far this year, the best novel, you know. I was trying to get my head around this idea of a novel that I thought of as a archival document, you know, could resonate so well. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this before I have to let you go, because I have run out of time officially. Are there Is there a lot of other stuff like that out there that's been sort of buried in these archives of scholarly workmanship, but that could be brought out now that couldn't get the publishers back then, but could now?
Well, you're going to have to drive down and take my Harlem Renaissance
okay.
class. Because, yes.
That's what you do.
That's what I do, yeah. It's not all buried now, I will say that, but there is material that the first Black queer story is by a guy named Bruce Nugent. It came out in this amazing document. I know your radio listeners can't see Fire magazine in 1926. And there's a novel by Wallace Thurman called Infants of the Spring, which is a satire on the Renaissance. And it has an array of LGBTQ characters and communist characters and so forth like that. You know, all the people that the FBI wanted to round up and put into prison, you know, and some of them maybe still do, I don't know. So the answer to your question is absolutely yes, that these exist, but they still are fairly obscure. And I think that there's a dominant sort of narrative of the Renaissance that tends to, you know, I don't want to overstate this too much, but tends to focus on more of what people think of as, I guess, more acceptable civil rights kinds of themes. But my point being that politics functions at so many levels. It can be gay, you know, LGBTQ politics. It can be women's, you know, politics. It can be women's rights and so forth. It can be radical socialism, you know.
Well, for now, that'll have to be it. Gary Holcomb, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, man. It was great talking to you.
Gary Holcomb, professor of African American literature and studies at Ohio University. Coming up, we're going to drill down a little bit to the local level. We're going to hear from Marshall Shorts Jr., of the founder and principal of Artfluential. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're looking at the relationship between art and political movements as we celebrate the life of Martin Luther King Jr. today. The Maroon Arts Group is a Columbus collective that promotes Black culture through art, education, and community events. Founder Marshall Shorts has also been instrumental in creating an initiative called Deliver Black Dreams that uses art to increase racial equality. Marshall Shorts, welcome back to All Sides.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
You've devoted your career to all kinds of artistic expression within the social justice, racial equality sphere of movements. The role of public art is particularly relevant. Why is that important?
I think it's important because it's an entry point into a conversation. As a colleague of mine, Prentice Andy, might say, politics is where people are some of the time and culture is where everyone is all of the time. So it's a powerful tool to have discourse and engage people in social change and creating ecosystems of change. And who better to do that than artists?
You know, I was just talking a little bit about, should all art be propaganda, as one great artist said, or should it be or should be devoid of politics and propaganda?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I was listening to the speaker before. He actually took my W.E.B. Du Bois comment. I always use that as an example. I think if you're talking about Black art, it's almost inherently, political or propagandish, so to speak, whether it's doing that intentionally or unintentionally. But I do believe that art can be intentionally political and intentionally, you know, asking certain questions. I don't know that to be true about all art, though.
Is intentionality crucial, or can things come from unintentional unintentionally? Does it have to have always an explanation of politics?
No. In short, I think it can, but I think art is always sort of asking questions about how we engage in culture and cultural production and things like that. So I think, it really kind of comes down to the artist and what they're trying to portray and to who they're trying to portray that message or image or story through.
What tell us about the impetus for Deliver Black Dreams initiative?
Yeah, so in short, it started as a multi-state project or campaign with a group of activists and organizers and Black leaders from Minnesota, Michigan, Ohio, as a race class narrative project that was seeking to use, Black culture to engage Black voters who are often disenfranchised from democracy and participating. We're, having voting rights fights right now. So it was, there's some discouragement that happens in that arena, and this is a campaign that was trying to combat that. But we saw an opportunity as protests started happening in the city of Columbus to marry the work of cultural production and art making, particularly in the space of Black art or our public art, to this broader conversation of political and civic engagement. And so, out of that, unrest and out of the, sort of explosion of art we saw downtown, we wanted to create a project or carry that project into the future beyond the protest. So how do we continue to have this conversation through the medium of public art and programming around what it means to deliver Black dreams in the city of Columbus and beyond.
And how does it look? What does it look like? What does it feel like?
We're still building. I mean, in 2020, we were able to put up three large-scale murals in the city of Columbus in 2021. And we're in 2022, we hope to continue that work intentionally trying to have the conversation around delivering Black dreams. But we also created programming around it, programs like Pitch Black, which is seeking to give micro grants to Black-led projects, working with artists directly or smaller murals and projects. But also, we did an unsummit with Emery Douglas talking about his role as, the Minister of Culture with the Black Panther Party. And so what does it mean like for an artist to be in service to an organization and membership of an organization and have a political home? So we're still building that platform, and we're hoping that it could become more robust and create a meta narrative around what it looks like to deliver Black dreams, not just in the art space, but in safety and education and in a city as a whole.
So it's so is that kind of what sets it apart from Maroon Arts group projects?
Yeah. I mean, I would call it a project, a collaborative project of Maroon Arts Group with Greater Columbus Arts Council. Councilwoman Shayla Favor helped support this, and it has to be a collective situation. The murals are collective and collaborative. We've had main artists who were coming up with the designs, but we also had, judges, community members, youth out to help paint these murals. So it's trying to bring together a couple different sectors that aren't always in conversation with each other.
It's interesting because if we think about, the movements over the decades, the political, the social political movements and the art associated with that, it's sort of from people outside of the government, outside of traditional institutions, right? And this feels like a turning point where traditional institutions are stepping up and helping fund and bring notice to it.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I hope that continues. I mean, you were just talking about the Harlem Renaissance and the outgrowth of that. Which, what isn't often talked about in that time period was the great level of violence, state violence that was enacted on Black folk during that great migration. And you see similarities today with the Black Lives Matter movement, and that being in response to, you know, state violence against Black folk. And so Columbus has had its own bouts with that. And so I think, you know, with the culmination of COVID and, you know, George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and many of the other folk who have, you know, been taken by state violence, you can't help but pay attention. And so the question now is like, you know, what role can artists sort of play in that civic discourse around politics? You know, I would love to see artists start running for office. You know, they have the ability to co-create, and writing policy is a creative act within itself. So if we don't take the opportunity to sort of look at if we overlook the large opportunity of this discourse between art and politics and things like that, I think we have to engage that more now than ever.
I mean, just when you just said having artists run for office, it got me all excited.
me too. That won't be me. But I have a good friend who recently just ran for the Near East Side Area Commission and won a seat, right? Who, he's an artist, he's a poet, he's a rapper, he's a community member. And so I think, you know, when you look at that trajectory, it's not out of the realm of impossibility. A lot of people don't know that Councilwoman Shayla Faber is a chef, right? So, you know, there's spaces where these things show up. And I think it's important to note that artists aren't just artists. They are artists and other things as well.
Exactly. I mean, they have to support themselves most of the time. And they have to be in a community, and their parents and their children and their all kinds of things. Is the movement reaching enough people?
I think it could be more, right? I think, you know, we don't know yet. I think, you know, everybody understands Black Lives Matters, but there is a number of different narratives that are circulating out there about it, right? So in terms of that specific, you know, term that everybody knows and movement that everybody knows, there's also local communities and organizations that are always and have been on the ground doing the work. And so, you know, with Deliver Black Dreams, you know, the hope is to further, you know, engage that work and help amplify the work that is already and has been done on the ground, particularly here in Columbus with the many activists.
Where can people see the art that's been created by Deliver Black Dreams?
Yeah, so there we have a website. We're going to be posting, you know, more pictures there. But if you want to see the murals live and in person, for instance, you can go to Fifth Avenue and Cleveland Avenue. So there's one there. There's also one on Wilson Road out west. And then the most recent one is near the intersection of Freebus and Allen Creek. So if you want to kind of get a feel, but you can always go to deliverblackdreamcbus.com or a Maroon Arts Group page or Art Makes Columbus. So, you know,
Greater
again,
Columbus Arts Council, right?
Art,
yeah.
Yep. If you want to see the art that kind of was archived from the protest and the tension that happened there, those are a couple of avenues to view that.
Right. I mean, that was a must-do thing before the beginning of the summer to get out and see those. Were they in place? But now they are archived, right? They've been saved.
Most of them, yeah. Yeah, I believe. I mean, you know, they're on board, so it's more ephemeral.
Yeah.
They don't last forever, so you know, there's efforts to, you know, collect photographs and things like that. But we wanted to make sure that there was more permanent installations like these Deliver Black Dreams large-scale murals that are on public walls.
Well, Marshall Shorts Jr., thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it. I look forward to hearing more about Deliver Black Dreams. Thank you.
Thank you.
Marshall Shorts Jr. is a creative strategist and community organizer. He's the founder and principal of Artfluential. That's a brand and design consultancy working at the intersection of art, design, cultural strategy, and social justice. And he's the founder of Maroon Arts Group, and also now, which is now part of this collaboration of Deliver Black Dreams. That's it for now. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.